Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Just ahead, the Reading Eagle has been a source of local journalism since 1868, but last week it filed for bankruptcy. We'll have a look at the state of newspapers in general and the challenges facing local journalism. Also, the Phillies home opener is on Thursday. The deal with Bryce Harper is generating a lot of excitement. Does the playoff drought end in 2019? But first, New Jersey legislative leaders and Governor Murphy are hoping that a vote to legalize recreational marijuana gets a thumbs up from the full legislature today. Legislation was passed by committees in the Senate and Assembly last week, but despite enthusiasm among some of the state's top Democrats, approval is not assured. Here with us now with the latest is Peyton Guyon, who's been following this story for NJ Advance Media. Hi, Peyton. Peyton, you there with us?
Hi, Mary. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. We can hear you now.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. Welcome to Radio Times. So Peyton, the vote as of now is set for noon. And at last word, legislative leaders were a few votes shy of passage. What, if anything, are you hearing?
So right now we're hearing that in the Senate, which is the body that votes at noon, that they're still anywhere from a few votes short to just a single vote short. The governor's office has said that they're about at 20 votes, but legislative sources are telling us that might be a little optimistic. So, we're really down to crunch time here, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Despite the support of Governor Murphy, the Senate president, the Assembly speaker, it has been tough to get some Democratic lawmakers on board. What are their concerns?
Early on, there were a lot of concerns about the social justice aspects of the bill. One of the big things that Murphy wrote into office on when it comes to marijuana legalization is this idea of expungements, which is clearing old convictions, in this case, marijuana convictions. And there were lawmakers who wanted to see the language be a little more progressive. And now we're at a point where it has gotten a little more progressive. And then now some of those lawmakers have been appeased. But we're looking at other Democrats who have been on the fence all along and are just kind of really reckoning with their conscience on this, whether or not they feel that legalization of marijuana is something the state should do.
And most, if not all, Republican lawmakers are against?
That's correct. Right now, they're working to swing a few Republicans, and it's looking like in order to pass, at least in the Senate, they will need at least a Republican vote or two. By and large, the Republicans are against, but there are some that are still in play.
So, Peyton, say this legislation were to pass and Governor Murphy were to sign it. What would the business of selling recreational marijuana in New Jersey look like? Who would be able to buy it? How much might it cost?
So what should be said first off is, let's say today the bill does pass and then a couple of days from now the governor does sign it. People who are listening should not go to New Jersey immediately expecting to be able to buy or use marijuana. It'll take a little while to get it rolled out, probably about 6 months before sales start. And that depends on whether or not New Jersey's existing medical marijuana dispensaries are allowed to sell to the public. It'll take probably a year from now before the industry really gets up and running. And so the folks that will be able to buy would be anyone 21 years old or older who comes into New Jersey with valid identification and goes to a dispensary once those are up and running. As for how much it'll cost, that'll sort of remains to be seen. We do know the tax on it will be $42 an ounce. That's imposed on the grower, but obviously would be passed down to consumer.
Sure.
And then there will be a variety of local taxes should the municipalities where someone's buying decide to impose those. So, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say if we look at New Jersey's medical prices right now, which are about $300, $350 an ounce, that might be a good place to think about where it would start. But really, we don't know until the industry gets up and running.
Well, so and again, if it does pass muster in the legislature, so if this does pass at that price, you know, would the poor end up going to the black market?
That's a really good question. Yeah, no, that's a phenomenal question, and one that some oppositional lawmakers have brought up is, you know, if prices are going to be so high because of this tax, we're not really going to get rid of the black market. I think it's probably fair to say that the black market will not completely dry up. That hasn't happened in any state where it has been legalized. But the thinking is if you can get an industry up and running where people don't have to worry about circumventing the law, that they'll go to that. So, you know, it would still be illegal, regardless of what happens today, to go buy on the black market. So the thinking is, if, you know, if we can stop arresting people for possession and things like that, that the majority of folks who are buying on the black market now will come to the legal market.
And this note, Peyton Guyon, correct me if I'm wrong, medical marijuana is not taxed and would not be taxed.
So the sales tax in New Jersey is currently imposed on medical marijuana.
Okay.
The bill right now is, there's also a medical marijuana bill that is tacked to the recreational bill today. If that were to pass, my understanding is that the sales tax on that would be waived, so patients would not be paying taxes.
How much money would taxing recreational marijuana bring into the state?
They haven't done a significant economic analysis on it since they changed the tax rate, but I think it's probably a good estimation to say, if, you know, anywhere from let's give it time for the market to get up and running. I mean, it's fair to say, you know, $100 million or more. And, you know, at first it'll be less than that. But once the market matures a bit, I think somewhere in that range is probably accurate for tax revenue to the state.
So give us a sense of how much that is relative to, you know, making a difference in trying to deal with budget issues, drop in the bucket, you know, something that excites lawmakers or.
So, I mean, it's one that has some folks excited just because it's a new industry and it's, you know, new territory for the state. But if we're talking about it relative to the budget, I think dropping the bucket is fair. I mean, New Jersey's budget is in the upper 30 billions. So, you know, when we're talking 100 million compared to 30 something billion, it's not a ton. But I mean, there's a chance that if this market really gets scaled up, tax revenue could be more than 100 million. So, you know, it's something that has lawmakers excited. But when you start talking about it as alleviating big budget concerns, that's kind of where, you know, that's kind of where some lawmakers have raised their eyebrows.
Peyton Guyon, let's talk some more about some of the concerns that some lawmakers have. Marijuana and driving. You can prosecute people for drunk driving. There are breathalyzers. There are blood alcohol tests. Is there a similar system in place for people who are high and behind the wheel?
And that's a really important question, one I've written a decent amount about. The short answer to that is no. There's no just roadside test similar to the breathalyzer where it'll give you a reading and you have a really good idea whether or not someone's impaired. And so what New Jersey's going to have to do is hire and train more what we call drug recognition experts. And these are specially trained police who are they're able to identify impairment, whether it's alcohol or drugs, in drivers. But you're going to have to hire so many more DREs to really cover New Jersey's roads that people are really concerned with this impending legalization, whether or not they'll be able to make a difference on the roads if a lot of people are driving while high.
No. There have also been questions about marijuana getting into the hands of children, especially when you talk about edibles. How is this addressed in the legislation, if at all?
There is significant language aimed at not packaging it or creating edible shapes that kids might either mistake for candy or be enticed by. So there are advertising restrictions. This is certainly something that they've contemplated. But then, you know, a lot of this is going to come down to responsibility of the consumer, you know, making sure you keep it away from kids. There's also really strong language about who can come into a dispensary and who can purchase and, you know, what identification they have to show. So they really are aiming to do what they can to remove kids from this situation. But as we've seen in other states, I mean, this, you know, it happens. Kids get their hands on this. So I think the regulators have to take special care to make this an issue, because I mean, none of us want to see kids consuming any of these products. Mm-hmm. So it's really going to come down to how well the regulators can oversee the industry.
On the local level, would towns and cities have any say as to whether legal recreational marijuana would be allowed within their borders if this legislation's passed?
The legislation is very clear that any municipality in New Jersey that does not want to have marijuana businesses in their borders can impose a ban on it, can pass an ordinance that would not allow marijuana dispensaries, marijuana growers, marijuana processors, any of that. What they can't do is they cannot prevent their citizens from possessing or using at a private residence within the town. That's something the bill does not allow. And so we've seen more than 60 towns in New Jersey already pass some sort of ordinance or some sort of ban on marijuana businesses. One thing that's kind of contentious right now is these towns, if the bill passes today and if it gets signed, they would have to do it again. The bill voids any ordinance that was passed before the bill was passed. So we'll probably see some towns that are upset about this having to go through the process again. But then we'll also see a whole bunch of other towns, I would predict, going through this step, once the bill has passed.
How might employers be affected, Peyton? Those who who've required drug testing, for employment.
And another great question, because it would seem if it's legal that you could use and you wouldn't have to pass a drug screening in New Jersey, but that's not true. The law gives employers the right still to screen for drugs, including marijuana. And obviously, if anyone is under the influence on the job, they can do whatever punishment they were going to do originally. At first, when the bill was released a couple of weeks ago, the language was a little fuzzy on that, and the business community pushed back and said, "Hey, we still need our rights to do this." And they said, "Yep, that was our bad. We will clarify this language," and they did. And so, yeah, it's not a lot's going to change in terms of drug screening, except you may see more businesses being a little more lax about screening prior to employment if marijuana would be legal.
If there is no vote today, or if the legislation is turned down, it will likely be a while before it comes to a vote again, or could it eventually go as a question to the voters?
We had reported over the past, going back to earlier this year and late last year, that if it didn't pass prior to the budget, and let's say today would be the last time the legislature would hear it, that if it did not pass, it would go to voters. Now, since then, the Senate President, Steve Sweeney, has said he would not put it to voters. This year is an assembly voting year, an assembly election which has low turnout, so he didn't think that was a good idea. Mm-hmm. So if it does not pass today, according to our reporters, best we can say is that they would try to tackle it in the lame duck session after the election in November. We could see something interesting and unexpected happen today. It is Trenton, after all. But according to our reporting, that's our best guess. If it does not pass today, we won't see it again until after the election.
So, and I'm asking you to prognosticate here in the remaining 20 seconds we have. But as a political observer, is it your sense that it is inevitable that recreational marijuana will be legalized in New Jersey?
If you're asking me for whether it's today or whether it's after the election or whether it's sometime next year, I think it is somewhat of an inevitability unless something major happens on the national level. So, yes, I would say it is probably an inevitability to pass at some point.
All right. Peyton Guyon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Peyton Guyon is with NJ Advanced Media, a reporter for that organization. Coming up, the Reading Eagle has filed for bankruptcy. We'll talk about why local newspapers and other organizations across the country are struggling. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We begin our look at the state of local journalism with a clip from The Simpsons.
With me here to comment on today's Democratic debate is Andrea Crowley of CNN, DeMont Evans of Slate.com, and Ron Lahar, a print journalist from The Washington Post.
Ha ha! Your medium is dying!
Nelson!
But it is!
There's being right and there's being nice.
And that's a lighthearted look at an increasingly troubling situation. Last week, the Reading Eagle newspaper, which first published in 1868, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The company saying its financial situation is no longer sustainable. Stories like that of the Reading Eagle have been all too common in recent years. Supporters are fighting to keep the paper afloat, but the number of news deserts has been increasing. A news desert is an area in which local journalism is shrinking or even non-existent. How does a lack of good local journalism affect the quality of life in communities across the country? Here with us now is Victor Picard, associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Sandberg School for Communications. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary.
So the Reading Eagle has a long and storied history as a news provider. Again, it's been around for about 150 years, and a bit of trivia. Many decades ago, the young future Pulitzer Prize winning author John Updike was a copy boy for the paper. Victor, what was your reaction to news of its bankruptcy filing?
Well, of course, I wasn't happy to hear about it, but I also see it as something that's becoming all too common. As you mentioned earlier, the rise of these news deserts is a national problem, and we are seeing communities across the country losing their only local newspaper. So it really should be seen as a national crisis.
Let's look for one more moment or so at the Reading Eagle. The chief financial officer says he's hoping to keep the Eagle in local hands. He's trying to put together a group of investors who would bid on the company. How challenging a process is this, considering what we've been talking about with the news deserts and, you know, more papers folding, more publications folding, in finding interested investors? What's your sense?
That's always a challenge, and we certainly can hope that it works out. It is interesting that during these moments of crisis, you do see local communities come together and really try to fight to preserve their local newspapers. So it's certainly possible, and that would probably be one of the best outcomes that we could imagine at this point. But unfortunately, it often doesn't pan out this way. These papers get bought up by private equity firms, or they just close altogether. And oftentimes, a few former journalists will try to create their own outlets and do the best that they can. But we don't have too many hopeful stories to point to, unfortunately.
Well, let's get to some of a story of a private equity firm. John Temple was editor of the Rocky Mountain News when it folded in 2009. There's apparently just one surviving major newspaper in Denver now. Temple doesn't mince words when he talks about the Post's current owner, which is Alden, Global Capital. He says it's plundering the paper. The catchphrase is vulture capitalism. How vulnerable are local and regional newspapers to organizations which don't embrace a news mission?
They're extremely vulnerable, and that's exactly the kind of trend that we're seeing where I think it's an apt term, these vulture capitalists swoop in, pick over the bones, as it were, and basically try to sell off what's left of the paper for parts and then just try to dump it, essentially. There's not any sort of association with the local community. These firms are really just trying to maximize profits, and it's a tragedy. And, you know, the Denver Post is sort of exhibit A for what happened. They're just a shell of their former selves, and the journalists themselves kind of tried to rebel against their owners and put up a valiant fight. But the way the structures are set up now, it's very difficult to resist these trends.
One more moment on Denver. Again, the Rocky Mountain News folded. The Post is a shell of itself. In a number of cities across the country, you had at least two major newspapers competing with each other for news coverage. What is the benefit of having a couple different publications covering the same area? What do we lose if one folds and the other's in danger?
Well, we lose what Europeans call media pluralism. We tend to call media diversity, but essentially we lose diversity of voices and viewpoints that are expressed in media. It's always better to have competition. But beyond that, it's just good to have many reporters on the ground covering their beats, generating original reporting information. And that's what a lot of people don't understand today, that as newspapers are struggling, you know, many people think, oh, they're just these old dinosaurs that are just being replaced by new technologies, new forms of media. They're actually not being replaced at all. And even in their struggling state, they are providing most of the original reporting for our entire news media system. So, when we lose newspapers, we really are losing journalism. And that's how we should be framing this problem.
So then, Victor, if I'm hearing you correctly, a great many news consumers simply are not going to traditional sources for their information. And at the end of the day, should I go as far as to say that's a dangerous trend?
I think it's very dangerous. I'm afraid throughout our conversation, I'll be sort of banging on this doom and gloom scenario, although, you know, there are a few positive developments that we can point to. But overall, it just means that people are not getting access to reliable information. And we now have many of the numbers. We know that since 2004, almost 1,800 local newspapers have closed or merged, declared bankruptcy. About 500 rural papers have closed down since 2004. And also what seems fairly intuitive, but now we have the data to show this, is that when a newspaper closes, there are tremendous social costs. We see studies show us that when people lack access to reliable local news, especially a newspaper, they're less informed about politics, less civically engaged, less likely to vote. We also find that without local journalists, there's less accountability and a rise of corruption and mismanagement in local governments. So there are these costs that we often don't consider when a newspaper is no longer profitable for its owners and is closed down or sold off to a private equity firm.
Victor Picard is associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Democracy Without Journalism, The Rise of the Misinformation Society. Victor, is it as simple as breaking it down to young versus not so young in the way we traditionally consume news?
I would complicate that a little bit. It is true that young people are increasingly not reading newspapers. So, you know, that is a problem. But I would back up a little bit and just point to the broader business model, which for 150 years thereabout has been based on an advertising revenue model. But as readers and advertisers move to the web, the digital advertising now pays pennies to the dollar of the traditional, you know, paper-based print media advertising. And what that means is that the business model has just completely imploded, and there's really nothing that's replacing it right now. Most of the digital advertising revenue that is being generated is going almost entirely to the duopoly of Facebook and Google. So there really isn't a way to monetize digital media, and that means there really isn't a commercial model. There are some news outlets that are trying, that are turning to paywalls and you know, online subscription models, but they're showing us a very mixed picture. Many news organizations simply cannot generate enough revenue through a paywall to sustain itself.
So are platforms like Facebook and Google responsible for the death or dying of local journalism in many parts of the country?
Yeah, so a lot of people are making that argument right now, and I would complicate it just a little bit to say that they are certainly culpable, and I do. I argue in many places that they should be doing more to help journalism, especially local journalism, but it would be unfair to say that they're the only one, that they're the main cause of this. Again, it's this transition to a digital format, and because the old advertising model was around for so long, we just thought of that as this kind of natural order of things. So it's hard for us to imagine different kinds of models. But really, journalism has almost never paid for itself. It's always been subsidized in one way or another. And for many years, it was an advertising subsidy that supported journalism. And now that that's gone, it's really hard for us to think of a new kind of model, especially non-market-based models, which is what I argue is really journalism's last best hope.
After Facebook was roundly criticized for the fake political news that saturated its platform, it did try an initiative called Today In, which turned out to be a real eye-opener for Facebook. Are you familiar with that, Victor?
I am. I haven't studied it closely, but I know that it is this local news initiative where Facebook is trying to promote local news, basically serving as an aggregator. And it sounds great. And, you know, Facebook has been doing a number of things where they're sort of indirectly trying to help local journalism. But just to give you one example where or why it's not working, they've found in many communities there simply isn't any local news to aggregate or promote. It's almost like trying to preserve a forest to protect endangered animals and then to find out that there are no tigers left in the forest. It's unfortunately too little too late in many cases.
So they couldn't find local news gatherers to offer solid local news stories. in many news deserts.
That's right. They're finding that many many communities across the country. I've seen various calculations. You know, there's at least 171 U.S. counties that don't have a local newspaper right now. I've heard 900 communities do not across the United States do not have access to local news. So yes, these news deserts really don't benefit from an aggregator coming in to try to gather up and promote local stories.
Victor Picard, let's talk about what happened with the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, you know, struggling mightily just a few years ago, and how the late Jerry Lenfest breathed or attempted to breathe new life into these publications. He donated them and Philly.com to a nonprofit which is now called the Lenfest Institute for Journalism. What do you think of this sort of model?
Yes, so this, I'm glad you asked me this, because this is one of the more hopeful stories that I can point to. And, you know, the jury is still out about whether this can save all newspapers, but it is a promising model. It's called a public benefit corporation, where they have it set up so that it's sort of a hybrid. It's still run, the newsrooms are still run for profit, but they are supposed to be devoted to a public service mission, which allows them to reinvest some of their profits, not just distributing it to shareholders, but reinvesting in the newsrooms. They're also able to take charitable contributions from foundations and other groups, which has allowed, I mean, just to give a couple examples, they have expanded their investigator reporter team from 6 to 13. So, you know, they're now able to do more investigative reporting. They've also set up a new program called Spotlight PA, where they're collaborating with some other news organizations to focus on Harrisburg and what's happening there. Because, of course, with news deserts, it's oftentimes state news, state legislature news that's not getting covered. So these are exciting developments. They're also hiring diversity journalists, placing people of color in the Inquirer newsroom for a two-year period. And that's another problem that journalism has long faced, with not having, basically not looking like the communities that they purportedly serve. So I feel like when you remove these commercial pressures, you're able to do some of these interesting experiments.
And is there interest across the country in this nonprofit model that you know of?
I've heard, you know, just anecdotally, there seems to be a lot of interest. There hasn't been a huge move towards this model yet. But I do think that as news organizations continue to struggle, I mean, we have major cities now that don't have a daily newspaper delivered. My hometown of Pittsburgh, the Post-Gazette now delivers 5 days a week instead of all seven. So, you know, we can see the writing on the wall, and we're going to have to find these new models where newspapers aren't entirely reliant on commercial revenue streams.
Now, worth noting, Lenfest believed a great newspaper was a civic treasure. So, all right. So major publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post seem to be holding their own. They benefited from the so-called Trump bump a few years back. Is the bump still a factor?
I don't know if I would still call it the Trump bump, but it is true that initially a lot of people thought, you know, we've made a turn and that this dark era of journalism suffering has come to an end, because it wasn't just those large newspapers. Publishers across the board saw this so-called Trump bump, but that fairly quickly dissipated. And now it's really just the major national newspapers. In fact, in many ways, they're trying to become international newspapers that are still doing well. I wouldn't attribute it all to the Trump bump, but I do think that they're able to generate more digital subscription, digital advertising revenue, even though that typically does not generate a lot of money. They're able to generate these new revenue streams that I think will allow them to be sustainable into the future. But it gives us a distorted view of how journalism is doing. It's really just those. That was the one thing that was wrong about that excellent Simpson clip in the very beginning, because the Washington Post actually is still doing well, along with the New York Times, but very few others.
Yeah, we haven't seen the trickle down locally, especially.
In the regional,
the rural areas especially. Just one more note there. An article in Nieman Lab has found less of what's called split-ticket voting since the demise of many local papers. Historically, Americans apparently have quite often voted for candidates of different parties on Election Day, maybe a Republican for U.S. Senator and a Democrat for president. If you lose local coverage, people tend more often to vote a straight party line. Victor Picard, what do we lose here?
Yes, so that's another important study that's come out showing that as these news deserts emerge and people don't have access to local news, they're more reliant on national news, and we're seeing a correlation, even direct media effects, where they're becoming more polarized. And you can imagine with many people watching either MSNBC or Fox News, they're no longer voting according to what's happening in their own backyards, and they're getting more swept up in these national debates that tend to be very conflict driven. And of course, the national news media are really often trying to sensationalize many of these political tensions. So that's having an effect on how people are voting.
Yeah, and there has been an increase in animosity toward the press since the 2016 presidential campaign. Is this affecting attitudes toward the preservation of local news?
Yes. So on one hand, and there's kind of a disconnect here, on one hand, we're seeing people value local news more. And that was certainly one of the first reactions after the 2016 election that, you know, we really do need to preserve the Fourth Estate. It's all that's protecting us from everything from fake news to even fascism, some would say. So while that is happening, we're somehow not realizing that there is not a business model. There's not a way to support the journalism that we now realize more than ever we desperately need. Have to bridge that disconnect. Yes.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. It was a pleasure having you with us. Victor Picard is associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
All right, we talk Phillies with Marcus Hayes of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News in just a moment. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Phillies open their season at home on Thursday against the Braves. And here to talk about Bryce Harper, Odubel Herrera, Cesar Hernandez, starting pitching, a promising bullpen, and the odds the 2019 Phillies might make a playoff run is Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Great to have you back, Marcus.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
So the $330 million man, newly acquired right fielder and star.
Remember when we were kids and we thought the $6 million man was something else?
I was thinking about that reference, but I thought that was throwing it way back to come up with that. But anyway, you know, Bryce Harper is 26 years old. He'll be 39 when his contract expires. What does he bring to Philadelphia?
He brings what Jim Thome brought. He validates the rebuild. He validates the marketing effort to convince people that Philadelphia is on the right track. Even though they had a substantial win increase last year, they didn't draw very well. And that's a big deal in baseball. The gate matters. So Bryce Harper makes that difference right off the bat, especially this season. They should probably draw close to $3 million for the first time since, I think, 2013. So, you know, 5 years of, attendance desert to piggyback on the previous segment. They need Bryce Harper. They need a face. And I believe that Rhys Hoskins, who will bat probably behind Bryce Harper, who had a transcendent rookie appearance in August 2 years ago and was probably their best, most valuable player last year, I believe he will benefit from Bryce Harper too. So there's a real trickle-down effect. And there are several other players in place as well that would have made the Phillies better. But Bryce Harper brings star power, and he validates the very long rebuild.
Let me just take a moment to get the number out, 888-477-9499, if you'd like to call into the show. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Rhys Hoskins is at first base. Is he ready on Thursday? He's had some shoulder issues.
They're very cautious with their players, especially their younger players. I'm not sure that him being at first base is the best thing for him and the team going forward, because not only does he have a shoulder injury, which may or may not be resolved, he may or may not play today, but he hasn't played in several days. So is he sharp? Is he ready for the season? Would he be better served staying at extended spring training just for, you know, two or three games? I mean, I tend to err on the side of caution when it comes to injuries, especially early in the season. If you're hurt in August, maybe you can gut it through. But if you're hurt in April, it could really deteriorate. I think people underestimate how much wear and tear baseball players undergo because it's kind of a non-contact sport. But it's a non-contact sport, you know, every day except for one or two per month.
There's a lot of repetitive motion.
Yeah. And the days are long. You know, those guys get there at 3 and they leave at 11 and they're doing something for 4 or 5 of those hours. So, yeah, it's a wear and tear sport.
So back to Bryce Harper. He didn't have much in the way of spring training. He seems to have warmed up, though, doing pretty well in recent spring games. With all the money, that $330 million, there's a lot of pressure to perform. From what you know of Bryce Harper, how does he handle this?
Bryce Harper was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he was 16. He quit school and took his, you know, GED so he could concentrate more on baseball. I mean, you can argue that he's a success story of where Todd Marinovich wasn't a success story in football. He is a success story concentrating on baseball at a very young age, which isn't uncommon across sports. I mean, gymnasts and golfers and tennis players all, you know, they commit when they're in their early teens, usually ice skaters. But yeah, Bryce Harper will have no problem being the face of a franchise and really the face of the game. One of the things about baseball, one of the reasons baseball has diminished in popularity is because for years there has been a reluctance of the star players to embrace their role as being the face of the game. You know, not everybody's like Joel Embiid. Mike Trout isn't. Mike Trout was criticized by the commissioner last year, Rob Manfred, for being reluctant to do more marketing. And he was criticized at the All-Star game. Mike Trout's the best player. He's one of the best players since Willie Mays. He's a transcendent talent and a wonderful human being and a dynamic individual, but he's reluctant to market the game. So was Barry Bonds, and so was Ken Griffey Jr. And, you know, I covered those entities, and it always baffled me why they wouldn't promote the game to help the people who were next, because it was – Their fathers helped promote the game so they could make the millions that they made.
Mike Schmidt had said something along the lines of he thought that Bryce Harper had the aura of a young Pete Rose.
That's right.
Coming in. Quickly to Mike Trout, of course, you know, Bryce Harper for about 30 seconds had the richest contract in baseball history. Mike Trout, $430 million. You know, we're close to half a billion here. To stay with the Angels, the local guy who's a big Eagles fan is not coming to Philly. Of course, he's staying with the Angels. Marcus Hayes, the numbers are getting so big, they almost don't even mean anything anymore.
Well, yeah,
I'm sure mean something to the people who are paying it out, but to really, fans, it's hard to get your head wrapped around.
It really is. I went into the stands the first day. I was at spring training a couple of weeks ago, and it was Bryce Harper's first day playing in the field. So I went out to right field to talk to some fans, and there wasn't after the initial great we have him for the Saturday before this Monday, it was a much more muted, a much more wait and see kind of, I guess, anticipation. I think in part because $330 million, I mean, that's the gross domestic product of 4 or 5 small countries in the world. I mean, it's just so much money for a guy who's so young and will be so old when he finishes. Now, the average annual value is about $25, $26 million. Mm-hmm. However, 5 years from now, $25 or $26 million for an elite player will probably be a pretty big bargain.
Yeah.
And it'll allow them to get more players. That said, it's really hard to grasp the magnitude of $330 million. I think Ryan Howard made like $175 million in his entire career. Bryce Harper in his best years has never compared to Ryan Howard in his best years.
And one more quick question before we move on. He was smacked in the ankle by a 96-mile-an-hour fastball.
There for that. Yeah.
But when something like that happens, you can get injured in baseball. Huge contract. How do negotiators go into this sort of thing knowing that, you know, you could end up on the sidelines for a long time if something happens?
Well, you know, if he's on the sidelines for 3 months of a 13-year deal at year three, you're probably going to forget that. And baseball is the most individual of sports. One player probably has the least effect in baseball compared to all the others because, you know, you're only going to get four or five chances defensively and only three or four at-bats offensively. You're 1/9 of the attack. So that's not true of elite hockey players or football quarterbacks or, you know, basketball stars. So they were fortified beyond Bryce Harper, and you have to be because 196-mile-an-hour fastball could put you out of commission and really diminish you for three. Even if it heals quickly, you have to go through spring training again. So it's it was an interesting moment. And all the backstory of that was Rhys Hoskins had nearly been hit by the same team the week before, and now they hit Bryce Harper, and it was the Blue Jays, and they see each other more than they see anybody else because they train maybe 6 miles from each other. So everybody was ready to fight from the Phillies. Everybody's
I was just
ready
wondering,
to go.
It sounds like a little bit of a conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. Rhys Hoskins told me, I was ready to go. I was in the on-deck circle, and if Bryce had gone, I was right with him. Mm. And Bryce is known to be a pretty short-tempered guy.
You did not get a story that day.
Well, no.
Not that story.
There was enough, though.
So Cesar Hernandez and Odubel Herrera missed some important spring play because of injuries. They are back. You say if they are healthy and effective, they will make the Phillies more than just a pretty face in the NL East. What does that mean?
It means that the other people that they added, the other players that they added, JT Realmuto, who is a transcendently good catcher, maybe the most valuable catcher in the game, which is something the Phillies probably haven't had since Bob Boone. Mm-hmm. Gene Segura, the shortstop, who he's not Jimmy Rollins, but he's the best thing they've had since Rollins and Boa at shortstop. Those two guys make a huge difference. However, if you supplement them with relatively homegrown talent. I know Odubel was a Rule 5 guy, but he's succeeded at the major league level with the Phillies. And he was an all-star. I don't know that Cesar can be an all-star, but he can be a very, very valuable guy hitting 1, 2, 6, 7, 8, or
Cesar's
9.
Cesar's at second.
Cesar's at second, and a very good second baseman. Yeah. But he's sort of playing in place of Scott Kingery, who was the big phenom last year, who's probably a better defensive second baseman than Cesar. I wouldn't be surprised to see Cesar moved at some point this season if things sort of fall right, if somebody comes after him. But that said, Cesar Hernandez and Odubel Herrera, if they are effective in the lineup, especially in the second half of the lineup, and if they are effective up the middle, they make this probably the best 1-8 team in the National League East. And that's saying something because the Braves and Nationals, their rosters are probably better than the Phillies. Mm.
But I'm hearing from you that we might likely end up in the playoffs this year.
I'm saying you got a chance.
Got a chance. Okay. So how's the starting pitching rotation shaping up? Aaron Nola, he's opening day, right?
He's opening day, okay. And he's probably their best player. You know, he's probably MVP with all this wonderful hitting talent and defensive talent that they've added. He's probably their most important and most valuable player. He's an ace.
And Vince Velasquez, though?
Well,
I've
always wanted Vince to be a closer. I think that you refine two pitches, you throw a fastball that's 98 miles an hour, you put him in the back of the bullpen, you only have to focus for 15 minutes, which is good for him. He's kind of a wild card, but then again, so are Jake Pivetta, who's getting the second start. I don't know that he's the number two pitcher. He might be the number two. He might be the second most talented pitcher, but he's getting the second start of the season, which means Jake Arrieta gets the Sunday night baseball start with all the hoopla, which keeps Jake Pivetta from having to start on Sunday night baseball as a younger player, right? Yeah. And Zach Eflin, I mean, we've seen flashes of brilliance from all three of the pitchers in the back end of this rotation, Jake Pivetta, Zach Eflin, and Vince Velasquez. But you need more than flashes from at least two of them this year. And, you know, there's a guy named Jared Eichhoff who they sent down a couple of days ago who's a real good, extra option. And I know a lot of people have been calling for a supplemental pitcher like a Dallas Keuchel, but the effectiveness of Keuchel compared to the effectiveness in small spurts of the three pitchers in the back end of this rotation are comparable. They're not identical, but if you look at certain metrics, they're comparable maybe all the way through, especially last season. So the Phillies are sort of standing pat. They're not sure that there's an upgrade out there. It'll be what makes her. It's the difference between 80 wins and 95 wins. Those three guys.
So maybe some October play this year.
Oh, absolutely. You should expect it. They should. As my contention is, if the last 2 weeks of September are interesting for your baseball team, then your baseball team has done you right. No baseball team is bulletproof. Injuries, bad years, age get to you. But if you're relevant, and every team should expect to be relevant in the last 2 weeks of September, who's within $20 or $30 million of the luxury tax threshold.
So moving away from baseball for just a moment, we've had some big news in local, college basketball here in the past week in the Philly area. Headline today in the Philadelphia Inquirer, your column, Marcus, Big Five losing classy coaches. Now, we had three coaches, in recent history, in local basketball, college basketball, who are gone. I love your line, A2 Bodensteiner. why don't you, so we've got about a minute and a half left here. Where were you going with that?
Jill Bodensteiner is the first-year athletic director at St. Joseph's, and she decided, with the support of the administration, to move on from Phil Martelli, who's been there for 34 years total, 24 years as the head coach, and sort of embodied that program. They're going to name the court after Phil Martelli. I believe that's one of my colleagues, Mike Jensen, came up with that idea, and it's going to happen. But he put them back on the map and produced NBA quality players who weren't necessarily NBA quality players before they got there. And his program has been ravaged by injury the 2 years preceding this one, and this one was disappointing, but we kind of assumed he'd get one more year the way a friend, or at least have a farewell tour the way Fran Dunphy did at Temple this season. Yeah. And the year before that, John Giannini, who took that LaSalle team to the Sweet 16 with three wins. He had as a play-in team as a 13 seed. I think it was back in 2013. It was he was let go last year. And as a sort of a general assignment reporter and columnist in Philadelphia, I got to know each of them pretty well to my benefit. And anyone who gets to know them, it is to their benefit. There are no three people I've been around who are more interesting, dynamic, of higher character, and with more charisma. And none of them is perfect, and all of them are kind of rough around the edges to a degree. But each of them is fascinating and really good coaches.
Big shoes to fill.
Really big shoes to fill. And Ashley Howard will do fine at LaSalle. He's the replacement for John Giannini. And Aaron McKee, former Temple player and a Philadelphia kid, will take over for Fran at Temple. So, it is a lot of pressure. It's not like replacing John Chaney as Fran was tasked to do, and went to the tournament 6 out of the first 7 years before they changed conferences. It's not that big, but it's big.
All right. So very quickly, Flyers are just about out of it.
Mm. Yeah,
Carter
Hart's wonderful. Jake Voracek, probably the best quote in Philadelphia sports over the last 5 years, said it's kind of a choking situation the way Terry Murray did in 1996. I don't agree with that. I'll probably write a column to that end today. They kind of overachieved once Hart was called up and Dave Haxtell, the coach, was fired and replaced. So I don't think that there's any choking situation.
Carter Hart, 20 years old, the goalie, star goalie for the Flyers, fun to watch. And very quickly, about 15 seconds left, Sixers are generating excitement too. You've got Joel and Jimmy, Embiid and Jimmy Butler.
When the starting five is together, the new starting five, they're 7-2. Let's wait until the end of April, mid-May, to determine on whether it's a great team and whether Coach Brett Brown should be held to task.
Still kind of a fun year for Philly
fans. It
is.
It's really fun. Every single sport has something to sort of recommend it to your entertainment value.
And we didn't even get to the Eagles. That's for a show down the road. Okay, Marcus Hayes, as always, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Marcus is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We've also got some great podcasts for you to check out. You can find it all at whyy.org/radiotime. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in.